Norman Lear is a legendary broadcast pioneer known for creating some of the most acclaimed and top-rated television series of all time. We just heard the theme from Maude, but his iconic shows include All in the Family, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Mary Hartman, One Day at a Time, and Sanford and Son, and the list goes on. Storylines in his show address subjects that were not typically discussed on television at the time, like racism, abortion, homophobia, class struggles, and politics. Lear has won 4 Emmy Awards and was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame. He is also the founder of People for the American Way. His memoir, Even This I Get to Experience, is now out in paperback, and it's a great thrill to welcome Norman Lear back to the roundtable. Norman, thank you very much for being with us.
I couldn't be happier to be with you, Joe. Thanks.
A great pleasure. We had the wonderful opportunity to speak with one another on stage in Vermont, where you have a home, around Thanksgiving last year when the memoir was just out. So it's a delight to have you back. Give us a sense of what this has been like over the past year of looking at your career and looking back and talking about what you have accomplished.
Well, it's been the thrill of thrills. I've been everywhere where the grass. My father used to say, "I've been everywhere where the grass grows green." He followed that with, "And that, and I know everything." I don't think I like my dad. I know everything, but I've been where the grass grows green in this country, and I've heard, you know, tens of thousands, literally, of people telling me. They used to watch, there were only 3 networks at the time, but they watched All in the Family, The Jeffersons, so, with their families. Their families watched it together, and they talked about the episodes afterwards. And that's, you know, I can't tell you the pleasure I take from that, that actually people talked about what they'd seen. It's very, you know, it couldn't be more rewarding.
There are many who say that we are currently in another golden age of television. And the last golden age was the age that you were very, very much a part of. I'm interested in what you make of such statements of do you think that we are in a golden age of television? Are we telling the same stories? And because of where those shows are broadcast, perhaps not family shows as the programs that I mentioned in the introduction that you were so responsible for?
Well, I do think it's a golden age in the sense that there is some glorious television. I'm not anybody who pretends to have seen it all. I'm constantly in a situation where good friends and people I respect are telling me, "You mean you haven't seen," and they're mentioning one show after another. It's impossible. You know, I think we are a country of total excess, everything in excess, and that's true of the amount of stations and the amount of content that we cannot keep up with. It's totally excessive. It is, in my experience, at least. So I watch Transparent because I think it's glorious, but do I see every episode? I don't, because somebody said, "You got to watch XYZ.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, they're just one show after another that, you know, deserves attention. And then there is, you know, I have all kinds of friends who are binge watching. I've not, and yeah, my wife and I have not gotten into the habit or the, whatever it takes to binge watch. I can't spend a day watching something. But I have great friends who do that all the time now, and that's the only way they can keep up.
And I'm sure you hear from people along this tour that you've been on for so long that people who are binge watching your shows, who are watching entire seasons of All in the Family and One Day at a Time.
Well, when they're watching my shows, I love to hear it. but I do run into that. It's a lot more difficult to get you know, a compilation of the All in the Families and so forth than it is some of the shows that are streaming.
Right.
But people are doing it.
In watching, and I've done this recently, where you watch an entire season or seasons of All in the Family or Maude, And you write about this in the book. The way you worked was fascinating because it was very much in the Broadway tradition. You wanted it to be a show where the actors were very close to the audience. In many cases, many cases, you hired Broadway actors to be on the stage, and it was a live experience. It's fascinating to watch. I assume
it was. I'm a theater buff, and we wrote and thought about these episodes of all the shows as one act plays. They took place for the most part in one set, and possibly with two, but usually one intermission, like a two act play. But the audience was 25 feet from the players, and you know, there's nothing like actor's ability to ride the emotions of a live audience. That's why when you look at All in the Family or The Jeffersons, the timing is entirely different from shows you may see that use a laugh track, because something hits, the camera is on Archie Bunker, he lifts an eyebrow and the laugh continues. You know, somebody shifts their balance in the middle of a laugh, and a laugh continues. It's a magical thing that occurs between the audience and the performer, and you only get it with a live audience.
When you were writing, were you looking for that laugh? I mean, did you know when it was going to hit? As a creator of these shows, of saying, okay, this is what we want the reaction to be.
Well, we wrote and understood where there'd be laughs, but the kick of working with a live audience was the laugh that you didn't expect. You understood once you saw it, but you weren't smart enough, wise enough, hip enough to understand it was going to come. And that was part of the joy of doing live work. The audience, the chemistry between the audience and the performers will often surprise you.
About 2 weeks ago, I had the pleasure of seeing Mel Brooks talk about, he was in town talking about Blazing Saddles. And one of the questions that came up inevitably was, could you do Blazing Saddles today? And in his answer, he mentioned your work as well, of much of the work that was being done in that time in the early 70s was to the point of that he doesn't believe that it could be done today. I'm curious as to your thought on that subject, and if so, what have we lost in that process?
Well, I can't say I know from personal experience that it can't happen today, but that's what I hear from people who are living that personal experience, from showrunners of shows that are on today. We couldn't do that, and you can't get that on. So, I have to live with what I understand they tell me is happening. The explanation for it is hard to find because there are shows on that are dealing differently, but just as daringly, with subject matter. Transparent, for example, is an example of. Although we touched on the subject in a show called All That Glitters in 1974 or something like that, It's alive and well and succeeding now, which is no less surprising than anything we did all those years ago.
Norman Lear is our guest. His memoir is Even This I Get to Experience. It is published by Penguin, and it is now out in paperback. Of the shows that you created, did you have a long-term arc in the sense of knowing what coming into various situations and saying, okay, maybe this isn't the right vehicle to tackle these issues, but if I create this show, I mean, the Jeffersons being a good example, that we could, okay, we can then look at this in a much more specific way than we can if they just remain the family that lives next to the bunkers.
Well, you know, the Jeffersons came about as much because the black press reviewing and commenting on Good Times, you know, started to in the third year or so say, why aren't there? Why do we have to see a black man while holding down three jobs? Why can't they be doing better? It dawned on us that the Jeffersons next door, we thought about moving them into their own show anyway, but moving them up might have come from you know, such pressures as that, and a visit a great many years ago at that time by Stokely Carmichael, who was running the Black Panthers or one of those angry black organizations, who came to my office to see what he called the garbage man, because he thought Good Times was garbage. And he was angry until we had a few minutes together, and then we were able to talk. And he was, you know, one of those people who, you know, wondered, is it possible that, you know, the only way we can see a black family is when they're struggling to make a living? And that and the pressure from black press and so forth, as much as anything, made us think, well, we have the Jeffersons, and Bologna, the character, Janae Dubois, who played Bologna, came up with the lyric, "Moving on Up." And that's what we did with the Jeffersons. We moved them on up.
We have talked, and of course, in when interviewers like me have someone have you on a program, we tend to talk about your television work because it's so iconic. And but because I have the opportunity, I want to talk about Cold Turkey. This was an amazing film, and I'm curious as to where it came in your career and how it was developed. You do write about it in the book, because of many things, it's hilariously funny, and also you get to see another side of Dick Van Dyke, which is just plain delightful.
Well, it came up actually when I couldn't get All I Made All in the Family. I made it twice for ABC, and they, you know, I understood the executives who saw it laughed their heads off, but they didn't put it on. They were afraid to put it on, and so I went out and made Cold Turkey. Cold Turkey. His last name was Fox. I can't remember two names that preceded it. So-and-so, you know, Fox, was a writer who wrote a book about a town that gave up smoking, or where the smokers pledged to give up smoking. Mm. And I loved that idea, and I loved the idea of a tobacco company that was misleading the American people to say they would provide the $25 million to the town that that would give up smoking, when what they were doing was really you know, creating a sales vehicle to market cigarettes under the pretension that they were doing good. So I loved that subject, and we did that. And Dick Van Dyke, as you suggested, was glorious in the film. And I'm as proud of Cold Turkey as I am of anything I'm connected to. And it is as, because I saw it just some months ago, and I think it's as relevant today as it ever was.
Norman Lear is our guest. The book, Even This I Get to Experience. You write in the book, "My political life shot into high gear in the mid to late 70s. The aroma of the dollars and my success led to my being solicited, it seemed, by every liberal, moderate, or progressive who held or ran for office in all 50 states. And calling me from then to now have been current leaders of the House and Senate, staff members and political advisors, the head of political organizations, and a few presidents." As you indicate in that paragraph, you were still very much a political animal.
Yes, I was. I think I went on to say in that paragraph that with all the visits and all of the requests for my advice, I don't recall an incident where anybody accepted it. What those calls and visits were really about was my Rolodex and my contributions, cash contributions.
Why do you think they were not interested in the actual content of what you were saying?
Because the people running for office and holding office in Washington are surrounded by their own people, and they are, in a sense, they're insulated. And despite their interest in what you might think, they're so insulated by their teams that surround them that, at least this is my experience, I can't recall a time when anybody really took what I had to say and did something about it.
Did you watch the Republican debate last night?
I did watch the Republican debate last night.
What did you make of it?
Well, I said somewhere, and I've seen it repeated, that I think more highly of the American people than their reaction as something to Donald Trump, for example, as something serious. I think it's the American people's way of extending the middle finger of their right hand to the rest of the establishment and saying, "This is the kind of leadership you get. Take this," and their middle finger is Donald Trump.
Mm. Do you think it'll last?
No, I don't think it'll last. I think the clowns will disappear. But the way I see those people, the clowns only disappear to reveal other clowns, a little less clownish, but clowns nonetheless.
So where
I'm
do
not
we?
Not happy with.
Yeah. So where do
where what?
Where do we get the comic relief that your shows brought of very serious issues? Where do we get that now?
Well, you get it by watching South Park. You get it by watching Modern Family. You get it by watching Family Guy. And you get it by understanding what you're seeing. I mean, in the tragedy of that debate last night, there was great comedy. There was a lot of foolishness of the human condition on display.
And that's a good point and a good distinction that in much of what you were writing about and much of the issues, many of the issues that you were dealing with, there was tragedy there, but you were bringing out the gut reaction that so many of us have and bringing out the humor.
Well, I look at life through the end of the telescope that sees the humor there.
At what point do you, I mean, I assume you've had pinch yourself moments in your life where you say, I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe that this has happened. But I would assume that when you buy an original copy of the Declaration of Independence, that's one of them.
Well, it was one of the great thrills of my life. I'm sitting with an associate who was with me when I read that the Declaration of Independence was going to be auctioned off on Sotheby's. I mean, by Sotheby's on the net, and we walked over together because I learned that the copy was in the office in Beverly Hills, the copy that was going to be auctioned off. We walked over together and approached it on a pedestal or on a stand. And I looked over to make sure she didn't see I was crying, and she was.
Mm.
And we walked back together after having seen it. And before I got to the office, I knew if I could get it, it was going to travel. I wouldn't think of getting anything, a document like that, and putting it up in my own home for the 11 people to see it. It had to be shared with the American people. So we did. We spent 10 years touring it. And it made 50 states, many states, multiple times, many cities in many states. But we finally reached 50 states.
Where is it now?
It's, I had a foundation I need to replenish because this had cost a great deal, and I sold it.
Mm.
And the fellow who bought it wishes to be anonymous, but he's building a museum, and it will turn up for the public in a museum.
Talk a little bit about your work with People for the American Way and why that was important for you to have this foundation.
Well, in 1980, 1979 and a half, I started to, I became very aware of the proliferation of evangelicals on television, the Pat Robertsons, the Jerry Falwells, Jimmy Swaggerts, Baker, all those. And I thought they were, you know, I laughed at the beginning, but then the mixture of politics and religion, which I found so anathema because it was so against, you know, the promises of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, etc. I began to take it very seriously. And I never would, decided to start an organization, People for the American Way. What I did was put a TV spot, a 60-second TV spot that I made, that showed a working stiff talking to the camera. He was sitting on a piece of factory equipment, a hard hat. And he was talking about, you know, he and his wife and his kids disagree about political things all the time. And here come some ministers saying they were good Christians or bad Christians, depending on their political point of view. Well, his situation was such that his wife, he knew, was a better Christian than he was. His kids were as good or better, and he was the favorite of the evangelicals, and he was the good Christian because of his political views, and they were not. And he thought from that, and he wound up saying, there's got to be something wrong when anybody tells you you are a good or a bad Christian, depending on your political point of view. That's not the American way. And I took that to Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame, and he endorsed it. He sent me around to a number of other mainline church leaders, and they endorsed it. And so I put it on a television station in New York, I mean in D.C., so that the Congress and, you know, the teams of people working for congressional leaders would see it. And they did. And it became a bit, it created a lot of noise. And two nights later, I found myself on the CBS Evening News, ABC Evening News, etc. And in somebody's office, as a result of all of that, publicity, somebody said, "You know, you ought to start an organization." And I like what that fellow says at the end. Call it People for the American Way.
Mm.
And that's how it came about. It was like an act of spontaneous combustion.
There's so much about your life. There's so much that you have accomplished, and you write about it beautifully. The book is Even This I Get to Experience. It is a memoir. It is out in paperback this week from Penguin Books. Norman Lear, it's such a thrill and a pleasure to speak with you. I thank you so much for sharing time with us, and thank you for being so great.
Thank you quite as much, and thanks for plugging the book. I appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much. Again, the title, Even This I Get to Experience, by Norman Lear, published by Penguin Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.